Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. The weather continues to be a big story, from mass flooding to devastating tornadoes, and hurricane season is on the way. Yet the future of forecasting is uncertain because of federal funding changes. We'll talk more about it. We also visit with immigrants in one Illinois city to find out how they're doing as the threat of immigration raids grow. We'll also learn how a Midwest jail has been used as a place to detain those picked up by ICE agents and the work activists are doing. This month marks 110 years since a major disaster along the Chicago River, when a ship known as the Eastland capsized, killing hundreds. We'll speak with the author of a book about the incident. And fireflies light up the night sky in the summer, but some have worried they're seeing fewer of the insects. We'll have a report. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Retirements and hiring freezes early this year raised concerns about the future of weather forecasting. Now, next year's budget proposal for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration amplifies those worries with cuts to several key programs and projects. Charlie Schlinker reports.
The proposed budget, released earlier this month, eliminates all funding for climate, weather, and ocean laboratories and cooperative institutes. It also does not fund regional climate data and information and climate competitive research, just to name a few of the cuts. Of the programs it keeps, the plan shuffles some into new agency homes. The U.S. Weather Research Program and Tornado Severe Storm Research and Phased Array Radar, for example, go from NOAA to the National Weather Service. Forecasters say they're worried about these things. WMBD-TV chief meteorologist Chris Yates says the personnel reductions so far have not had a big impact. For the most part, Yates says the forecasting models are still performing well.
We have lost some observation data out west, mainly some weather balloon data. So far, I haven't seen a huge reduction in skill as a result of that, but that is a concern for many of us in the industry.
Yates says weather balloons not launched have relevance for central Illinois.
There are a few sites, particularly near the Rockies, that are crucial for kind of painting a picture when areas of low pressure reemerge on the eastern slopes of the Rocky Mountains. So not having that could eventually lead to some problems. Weather balloons give us our most complete picture of the entire atmosphere from the surface all the way up through the beginning parts of the stratosphere.
Yates says there are ways to compensate for the loss of weather balloon data with satellite scans, but Yates and WEEK-TV chief meteorologist Chuck Collins both say if you don't have good and plentiful data going into the forecasting models, what comes out will not be as robust and detailed as you might wish.
The Weather Service was understaffed to begin with, and now positions aren't being filled. There are meteorologists in, you know, multi-day severe weather events. They're working double shifts, you know, several days a week. So it's an overall big problem.
It's more than just the weather event itself, Colin says. It's the aftermath. He says chances are those same people would have to go out after the storms and survey damage for days.
There's a lot of tired meteorologists out there.
Colin says you can compensate some by having staff at locations that are not having severe weather sub in remotely. But lack of staff drags down the overall resiliency of the service. For instance, the radar technician is gone at the National Weather Service station in Lincoln. If the radar goes down, somebody has to drive from Indianapolis or Chicago to get it back up. That's what's happened so far. What's coming could be very different. University of Illinois climate scientist Jeff Frame studies severe thunderstorms, things like supercells. Frame says the new budget for NOAA abolishes a lot of stuff. Even where there are reductions but not eliminations, he says the document can be deceptive. Case in point, the National Severe Storms Laboratory is one of the research labs of NOAA. That's cut entirely. One of the products the lab is developing is called the Worn-On Forecast System. That's a computer system that uses an ensemble of computer forecasts that also uses current weather data. Frame says the National Weather Service uses Worn-On to bridge the gap between a watch and a warning.
And say, well, we got a storm coming, maybe it's 2 hours away, is it going to strengthen, is it going to weaken, what are we going to do? Worn-On forecast is a real key to that.
The budget proposal says some of the severe storms and tornado research is supposed to go to the National Weather Service. Frame says the budget request actually says Warn-On will be discontinued and reevaluated later.
That's great. That means that everyone who's working on that system now and who built it is going to go away, and then you're going to try to restart it with all those people gone, and that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
The National Severe Storms Lab also does social science research on tornadoes and severe storms. For instance, the recent Texas flooding had excellent warnings. The Weather Service did its job. But Frame says if the warnings aren't acted on or are misinterpreted, it doesn't help anyone. He says the lab does valuable research on that kind of gap. The new NOAA budget allocation for maintenance is growing, not falling. But WEEK's Chuck Collins says there are additions to current technology that should increase as well.
Wind farms actually can interfere with the radar, and they have so many wind farms, especially Logan and McLean counties. There's talk the Weather Service here locally may need another radar somewhere, maybe in eastern Illinois, to cover some of the overlap because we're getting some interference.
That may not happen under the new plan. Here's another example of the value of tech investment and of research. 15 years ago, the National Severe Storms Lab upgraded all the Doppler radars in the country. Climate scientist Jeff Frame says that allowed meteorologists to say something about the shape of what's scattering the radar beam in the atmosphere.
We're able to actually sense tornado debris now with our radars, and TV weathercasters as well can show this product on air and say, here's a debris, now get in your basement, don't stand out on the porch looking for it.
And Frame says next generation radar is at risk. The current Doppler radar technology is about 40 years old.
What they do is they're able to scan storms much, much faster. Whereas the current radars, they have to, the beam goes around in a circle, and then it goes up to the next elevation, goes around in a circle. And the whole process of scanning a storm, if the radar works its fastest and hardest, still could take something like 5 minutes. And 5 minutes is, you know, kind of an eternity in terms of a tornado.
In comparison, the average lifespan of a tornado is less than 10 minutes. Frame says they're developing what's called phased array radar to succeed it, and the new budget puts funding for implementation at risk. A special report of the American Meteorological Society notes weather information and the protection it provides life and property support the nation's economy. The Meteorological Society says the value of weather and climate information to the U.S. economy is more than $100 billion a year, 10 times the investment from taxpayers. In 1999, Hurricane Floyd came from the Bahamas and moved parallel to the east coast of Florida. It eventually made landfall in North Carolina. That storm prompted the evacuation of the barrier islands on the entire east coast of Florida. At the time, it was the largest peacetime evacuation in U.S. history, and that hurricane never hit Florida. Hurricane Dorian in 2019 took a very similar path, and they didn't evacuate. U of I's Jeff Frame says they were fine because forecasts had become more accurate. He says improving forecasts can, in one event, save millions in the economy.
People are evacuating, so they're taking off work, so they're not making money, and right, they're not paying taxes on that money, right? So it's not just the businesses and the people, but it's also the local governments that take a hit. Tourists aren't there, they're not paying sales tax.
Ending research, Frame says, gives up the potential for future refinements that could make that kind of difference. The Meteorological Society report says about a third of the U.S. economy is sensitive to weather and climate. And meteorologists Chuck Collins and Chris Yates say they too are concerned about possible issues with updates when trying to improve model accuracy down the road. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
For the last few years, people have worried about lightning bugs. Many say they're seeing fewer of them. We take a look at how firefly populations are doing this year. From member station KBIA in Missouri, Rebecca Smith brings us the story.
It's a hot, very humid night at the Forum Nature Area in Columbia, and I'm being eaten up by mosquitoes while running around trying to catch fireflies.
Come here, fireflies. Ah! There we go, I got him. Hello, friend.
It's such a nostalgic experience, which is a common thing to hear from folks in Missouri. Memories of sitting outside on a hot, heavy summer night, watching the lightning bugs. During the last few years, there have been reports of fewer and fewer of the insect, which is why many Missourians have shared their surprise and pleasure at seeing what they perceive as more this year.
This year is definitely up from the last couple of years.
That's Steve Bubeck. He's a natural history biologist with the Missouri Department of Conservation. He agrees that greater numbers of fireflies have been gracing the evening sky lately, but he stresses this isn't necessarily an indicator of long-term population growth or recovery.
We tend to think that firefly populations go in cycles with rain, so a nice wet year like this allows those little larval fireflies to survive a lot better.
And numbers are drastically down compared to 50 or 100 years ago. Bubeck says there's a lot of possible reasons for the reduction in firefly numbers across the state, such as light pollution and habitat loss. Fireflies are most successful in areas of moist soil with tall, unmowed grasses, and this has become less and less common as time has gone on. According to the Nature Conservancy, Missouri used to have 15 million acres of grassland as recently as the mid-1900s. Now, less than 1% of that prairie remains.
You took a look at all the places we've impacted heavily, and they've just lost a lot of space to live.
Pesticides and herbicides are also a major concern for firefly population health, not just because the chemicals could harm the insect, but also because it reduces food sources for firefly larvae. Emily Althoff is an MU Extension urban entomologist and says fireflies actually spend the vast majority of their lives, years in some cases, as predatory armored larvae feasting on traditional garden pests such as snails, slugs, and earthworms.
And then they'll become pupa, sort of like our butterfly life cycle. We know that that's that complete metamorphosis. They completely change is how I like to say it.
So she says the best way to ensure that firefly populations stay healthy is to focus on the needs of the larvae and not just the more flashy adults. Luckily, she and Bubeck agree that while firefly conservation is not as simple and straightforward as, say, planting more milkweed for monarch butterflies, there are still lots of ways people can help, such as mowing less often, leaving the leaves in your yard, and limiting outdoor lighting. For anyone worried about whether or not it's okay to catch fireflies, Althoff advises temporary enjoyment.
I think catch and release is just fine. It also really instills this core memory and care into the next generation of human beings and potential scientists and potential next generation of entomologists or conservationists, and even just the general public to care.
But she reminds folks to be gentle with the bugs and release them where you found them, so future Missourians might see the same number of fireflies their ancestors did. I'm Rebecca Smith, KBIA News.
Immigrant families are trying to settle into life in a new country while immigration raid fears grow. From Rockford, Peter Midland has more.
Some of the individuals we spoke to came to the U.S. seeking political asylum, while others arrived through a Biden-era humanitarian parole system. At the end of his term, Biden chose not to extend that program, which the Trump administration ended. Now, immigrant families using that legal pathway have to seek other options while worrying they could be detained by ICE without their day in immigration court. Rosa and her three kids moved to Rockford about a year and a half ago after a long, dangerous journey from Ecuador. They traveled through treacherous jungles and areas known for armed kidnappers. She knew the risks and said she would do anything to give her kids better education opportunities and escape violence in her former country.
Yo moriera por cuidar a mis hijos.
So, for example, I would die to take care of my kids.
We chose not to use Rosa's real name due to privacy concerns in the U.S. and in her home country of Venezuela. Making that perilous trip with three young kids was challenging, and she didn't want to scare them, so she tried to hide how much danger they were actually facing.
Como niño, lo tomaron como un tour.
With kids, the way that I treated it was like we were going on a tour.
The person translating is Amanda Mayle from Rockford Action for Immigrants. They help resettle families like this and assist with housing, clothing, legal services, and more. Rosa's three kids are all in school in Rockford now, and she says It's been a difficult transition, particularly for her middle schooler. New country, new language, new school. It was overwhelming. But then volunteers helped him find a soccer team, which Rosa says has been like therapy for him.
Sin embargo, cuando ya empezó con el fútbol, ya venía cansado, ya, o sea, la adaptación fue mejor.
And it helped him a lot. He wasn't even sleeping. And then he got into soccer, and he would come back tired and would sleep.
Her daughter just graduated high school and plans to enroll in college.
Un orgullo y quiero que siga estudiando porque no quiero que ella pierda ese ánimo.
For me, it's such a like a proud moment, like as a mom, and I want her to keep studying because I don't want her to lose that energy and that drive.
After the long journey, she says they're finally realizing their dreams. But the increase in immigration raids and detentions have her worried. A few weeks ago, her son was at soccer practice when news of ICE sightings in Rockford reached them. Her daughter was supposed to have a college meeting, but they stayed home out of fear. And on the other side of Rockford, two brothers also moved to the city nearly 2 years ago. We'll call them Luis and Francisco, and they're originally from Nicaragua.
Que entiendan de que nosotros no venimos a robar un trabajo, a causar daños a nadie.
I want them to understand that we didn't come here to steal a job or cause any harm to anybody.
Nosotros solo venimos a ofrecer un mejor futuro para nuestra familia.
We just came here to offer a better future for our family.
They're both fathers of twins, but their kids had to stay behind. Luis says the public education system in Nicaragua isn't very good, but now, thanks to the money they're earning in the U.S., they can afford to send their kids to private school.
Darle lo mejor, un futuro mejor. Actualmente estudian inglés, algo que yo allá no le podía pagar.
They're studying English now. Before, I wouldn't have been able to provide that opportunity for them.
Francisco says it's been really hard and stressful being away from them for so long, but they still get to call each other every day. And Luis says they talk about the chores they're helping their mom with and how they want to come to the U.S. to study someday.
Que todos los días le piden a Dios para que podamos estar juntos.
And every day we are asking God to bring us together.
Francisco looks at a photo of his family on the beach where they ate together for his going away party, and Luis thinks about saying goodbye to his children.
Pero sí, el último día, pues, de que miré a mi hija llorar cuando yo me venía para acá.
It was hard on my last day at home to watch my one little girl cry so much.
And despite immigration concerns, they still hope that one day they'll be reunited here in the U.S. to keep pursuing their American dream as a family. I'm Peter Mudlin.
Statewide continues in just a moment. And we're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, we'll look back at a major disaster in Chicago 110 years ago this week. But first, a bill that would have established a new funding formula for state universities in Illinois wasn't included in the $55 billion state budget approved. Democratic Senator Mike Halpin says it would have leveled the playing field for public universities, but it never came up for a vote. Jane Carlson has more.
Halpin introduced Senate Bill 13, which would have applied the evidence-based funding model for public K-12 schools in Illinois to state universities. Halpin says the bill never came to a vote, but it would have evened the playing field for public universities.
There are certain universities that are very, very well funded, are showing increased enrollment. And then you've got our regional universities, which are suffering because we've been underfunding them for so long. It's a great bill, and hopefully we'll consider it in the veto session coming up this year.
Halpin says making sure Western Illinois University can be successful is his top priority in a district that stretches from Moline and Rock Island down to Macomb and includes both Western campuses. The proposed new funding model in the bill called for adding around $135 million a year for state universities. Western would have had top priority for that funding because it's the most underfunded university in the state in terms of resources needed to meet adequacy targets in an evidence-based model. Halpin says the added spending on state universities would be worth the investment, especially when they've been underfunded for so long.
We spend more on that on our healthcare. We spend more than that our K-12 education. We spend much more than that on our roads and bridges. Now, these are all important priorities, but higher education needs to be at the top of that list as well.
Halpin is also the Senate sponsor for a bill that would allow Illinois community colleges to grant 4-year degrees. He says he's tried to bring state universities into that conversation by making sure the bill addresses a group of students who wouldn't likely attend a four-year college.
It's really designed for those students who aren't choosing between community college or Western Illinois University, but are choosing between community college or no degree at all. We've built in a lot of protections to make sure that that competition isn't taking place. And I do think it will benefit students without hurting the universities.
Halpin says another priority is funding for K through 12 education. He says evidence-based funding for those schools has been a success, with school districts getting enough money from the state that they aren't raising their property tax levies. Halpin voted against Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker's budget, saying it did not include enough priorities for Western Illinois. I'm Jane Carlson.
Hydropower is one of the oldest sources of energy. It dates back to at least 2,000 years when water mills would crush grains and break ore. Today, hydropower accounts for nearly a third of renewable energy in the U.S. But as the Harvest Public Media contributor Teresa Homsey reports, federal hurdles may prevent older hydroelectric plants from staying online and new projects from getting off the ground.
Inside the Sioux Hydroelectric Plant in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, 74 turbines are spinning and generating power for thousands of homes in the region. This narrow plant is a quarter mile long, and its red sandstone bricks harken back to the Gilded Age, when the plant first opened in 1902.
And it's been running pretty much 24/7, 365 since then.
Roger Line is with the Cloverland Electric Cooperative, the utility company that owns the plant today. He says Cloverland's considered shutting the facility down.
If you were to buy the same amount of energy out on the market today, you could probably get it a little cheaper.
Ultimately, Cloverland kept the plant open. It's not expensive to run and still generates a reliable flow of energy. But this back and forth isn't uncommon. A 2022 survey conducted by an engineering consulting firm found that about 36% of hydro operators in the U.S. were actively thinking about decommissioning their facilities. Unlike wind or solar projects, hydro facilities require a federal license that must be renewed every 30 to 50 years. And plants often have to deal with dozens of federal, state, and local agencies. It can be a bureaucratic nightmare, according to Malcolm Wolf from the National Hydropower Association.
It takes, on average, almost 8 years to get a existing hydropower facility relicensed.
40% of the nation's fleet that's not federally owned is facing license expirations in the next decade. The process, Wolf says, should be streamlined. He says there also needs to be a way for agencies to settle disputes when they impose contradictory requirements.
Part of what makes the hydropower licensing so maddening is that there's no agency in control. If one of the dozens of agencies misses its statutory obligations, there's nothing anyone else can do about it but wait.
Right now, hydro provides 6% of the nation's electricity generation. Caitlin Grady is a civil engineer with the George Washington University. She says hydroelectric is important, especially if we want to cut down on emissions.
Without major changes in nuclear or hydro, we will not have a sustainable grid with just solar and wind unless we're also building a ton of batteries. And I mean tons and tons and tons of batteries.
Instead, Grady says grid reliability and energy output could be expanded by adding turbines to existing dams and investing in modern pumped storage technology that uses water and gravity as a battery. But century-old hydroelectric plants are still churning out power. At the Keokuk Renewable Center, which sits on the Mississippi River, bordering Iowa and Illinois, operators say it's been business as usual since 1913. Brad Todd with Ameren says there's no plan to decommission Keokuk, which supplies electricity to 75,000 homes a year.
It's great for the customers, it's safe, it's efficient, and Ameren plans on keeping ours around basically forever if we can.
The plant has new turbines that are more energy efficient, because even as technology changes, the basic idea remains. Water keeps on moving. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Teresa Holmesy.
This month, in 1915, one of the most tragic events in the history of Chicago and the state of Illinois occurred. 844 people died in a horrific scene along the Chicago River, and yet most have never heard of the Eastland disaster. Michael McCarthy is author of the book Ashes Underwater, the SS Eastland, and the Shipwreck That Shook America. He takes us back to July, 110 years ago.
We are on a misty Saturday morning in July of 1915 and it's about 7 in the morning, and this steamship, large steamship that is as large as a football field, is loading up with 2,500 people. Most of them are factory workers, poor, a lot of women and children. The ship goes into a half an hour sort of sequence of topsy-turvy behavior in which it spins, it begins to turn toward the dock, turns away from the dock, it turns back toward the dock, and eventually it spins completely over. It lands on its side. It's at the Chicago River. It's immediately fills with water, and 844 people drowned within minutes.
What caused this shifting of the ship?
What exactly happened, we haven't known. We haven't known in the past 100 years since the tragedy what caused it. And what I found in digging through National Archives records is that there was actually a plausible explanation. What we determined, what we can see from the evidence that prosecutors gathered, was that there were cruel business owners who ran the ship, who knew the ship had stability problems. They began discussing specific repairs to fix water pipe stabilizing machinery deep in the hull of the ship, and then they neglected to follow through. Cutting corners, they decided to wait until the 1915 sailing season was over, and that cost the Eastland victims their lives. And I think that they neglected the needed repairs is not an author's speculation or theory. This is the explanation that vividly emerges from the evidence that was painstakingly gathered by the police and prosecutors in the summer of 1950. I think that no one was found criminally responsible for the deaths of 844 people, many women and children, as I mentioned, is one of the great injustices of the 20th century.
For a lot of people, it might be hard to imagine that something along the Chicago River there could lead to such great loss of life. It doesn't seem like it's that far away from land or maybe the dock in this situation. You know, why weren't people able to get back to the surface and possibly be rescued?
Yeah, the scene was incredibly chaotic. You have to imagine the Chicago River at the point at which the Eastland sank, it was just about 19 feet from its dock. So people literally could almost reach across, and they could almost leap to the ship or leap to the dock. The problem was that the way the ship sank and the way the ship was designed, there was really only one main stairwell out from the middle decks out to the top. That stairwell quickly became stampeded by all the people trying to get out and clogged, and essentially everyone then was blocked from being able to exit the ship. The other thing is, it's a horrible scene to think about. This is a ship that suddenly turns sideways. So think if you're in a house and it's sideways. Think about a stairwell that normally would go up. It's now going sideways. And if you try to step on a stair tread, you're simply going to slide down. On top of that, you're in a ship that has corridors. You're trying to wind your way out. It's as if you're in a maze that's turned sideways. So nothing is working for a smooth exit. Okay, say you manage to get out and you're up at the top of the water. People are clawing and screaming and flailing in the water. And there are instances we know of men who didn't know how to swim, grabbing hold of young women and drowning them. I mean, it was a tremendously chaotic scene. On top of that, there was a lot of debris that was thrown. This is the place this happened on the Chicago River was in a warehouse district, largely a fruit production area and fruit retailing area. So there were a lot of crates that were being thrown in, crates for fruit, life preservers, all kinds of debris is flying down. Some of it hit people in the head and knocked them unconscious. And, you know, and on top of on numerous other complications, the women were in very typical apparel for a nice day out in the summer, a summer picnic, which would have been ankle-length dresses and skirts and shirtwaists and so forth. So they're not exactly in the best apparel suddenly to be dumped in a river and trying to swim. So for all these reasons, the tremendous loss of life.
We're talking with Michael McCarthy. He's the author of Ashes Underwater. It focuses on the Eastland disaster. Why, as a society, is this so forgotten? I mean, this is a tremendous loss of life. It happened right here in Illinois. I bet most people don't even remember it.
You know, I'm ashamed to say I didn't know about it. If you think about it, I lived and worked. I grew up in St. Louis, lived and worked in Chicago for about 7 or 8 years with the Wall Street Journal before I'd ever heard about it. And so I was one of the, you know, people who was kind of blindsided by it. But, you know, it's a very good question. Why have people forgotten? Well, I think there's a couple good reasons. One is that none of the passengers on the ship were affluent or prosperous or celebrities, right? So when we had the Titanic, we had the unsinkable Molly Brown and some other rich aristocrats who died. In the case of the Eastland, it was all factory workers. There was one particular factory in Chicago called Western Electric. They made, if you can remember, what's called the candlestick phone. It's the phone in which it's like tall, looks like a candlestick. You'd remove the receiver and hold it up to your ear. The Western Electric Company was the only producer of phones in the United States. It was right there in Chicago, and they were having a company picnic. So most of the employees were on the Eastland at the time it sank. So these were not well-known people. These were not people who write memoirs or would be normally written up in the newspapers if they died. Okay, aside from that, immediately after this happens, the accident happens in July of 1915. There's a trial in 1916 to try and bring those responsible to justice. By 1917, the United States is in World War I, and that really changed a lot. And I think that the Eastland story got buried in the absolute world-changing events of World War I. And I think that's a problem. And finally, I think one of the reasons it's been forgotten is because, like I said, until I did my research and wrote my book, we haven't really had anyone to blame. There was no one really guilty. It just seemed like the boat tipped over and no one knew why. And I think that probably kept it from being a legacy of history that we would know about, something that we would know, like the Lusitania or the Titanic.
Well, mentioning the legacy of the Eastland, I was surprised to learn that the ship itself continued on sort of in a second life, and it involved the military.
It did. Well, after the sinking, it took them a month before they actually could pump it out, raise it back up, and figure out what to do with it. At this point, the military, the Navy, took over the ship. They cut a couple decks off of it because, you know, they decided they were going to use it as a training vessel for military maneuvers, for naval maneuvers, and they didn't need all the cabin space that you would use for a, you know, sort of a cruise ship for passengers. They also made key changes to the stability system that the Eastland owners had contemplated doing but failed to do. So once the mechanical flaws, once the fatal mechanical flaws were repaired, the ship was perfectly fine. But, you know, that, unfortunately for all the victims of the Eastland, that hadn't been done until the Navy had taken the ship over.
What can society learn from something that happened so long ago?
It's a great question. And I think it's always important to expose how calamity can result when corporations put profit in front of people's safety. The Japanese company that has the airbags in autos that have led to fatalities, and Congress is after them. We have the auto industry, which has had congressional hearings and problems of their own with mechanical flaws that have led to people's death. So anytime we have a story that shows how this can happen, the efforts to bring people to justice, and how those efforts can be thwarted, I think there's some good lessons for us. And particularly, you know, when you think about the transportation industry, which is all I'm talking about now, whether auto or ship, you're moving many hundreds of people. In the case of autos, you know, millions of people. And so when something's wrong, those numbers can quickly mushroom, very quickly mushroom. And for Illinois or for Chicago, just even to talk about a little local relevance, there are thousands of descendants in Chicago and elsewhere, relatives of Eastland victims, who really deserve to know the full story of how and why their family members perished horribly. There were 22 whole families who died on the Eastland. As I mentioned, this is a company picnic. So maybe the father worked in a cable department. He would bring his wife. They'd bring their children. Often there was a grandmother living in the house. That whole family went on the Eastland. There were many of those. and 22 entire families died on a single day, in just within minutes there on the Chicago River. And given that, when I think about that, I realize that this historic tragedy changed the architecture of family trees forever.
Michael McCarthy is author of the book Ashes Underwater, the SS Eastland and the Shipwreck That Shook America. The Eastland tragedy happened in July 1915 along the Chicago River and killed more than 800 people. There is more ahead on Statewide. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. These days, teens often question whether college is still the best path to a solid career. A new study says yes, but there are caveats. Summer Van Benten reports.
Sarah Cashdollar is a researcher with the State Collaborative that did the study. She says looking at the trajectory of Illinois youth, it's clear that education can help make the American dream achievable.
In general, the education pays off. However, it doesn't entirely erase those differences by economic origins. So we saw students from lower income backgrounds tended to earn lower level credentials.
She said a lot of low income students start college but don't finish, and that impacts their earning potential. Next, researchers will look into low income students who beat the odds, landing high paying jobs compared to their peers. Summer Van Benten, WBEZ News.
A nonprofit that supports immigrant rights in central Illinois is urging families not to panic and to get their paperwork following a U.S. Supreme Court ruling. The high court decision limits judges' authority to issue nationwide injunctions, such as the ones that were intended to block President Trump's order that denied automatic citizenship for all U.S.-born children. Madeline Cox-Guerra is a staff attorney with the Normal-Based Immigration Project and represents about 35 immigrant families across central and southern Illinois. She told Eric Stock the ruling is a devastating blow to immigrant rights.
What this decision means is that moving forward, there's not going to be a universal bar on removing citizenship benefits or citizenship documents across the United States.
And so what do you think that will lead to?
I think it's very likely that in the jurisdictions where the executive order has been blocked, it will continue to be blocked. So, for example, in the District of Maryland, for example, the executive order is not going to go into effect. However, there are several other states and other locations and other jurisdictions where the executive order could begin going into effect. And that is damaging because there are going to be kids born in the United States that have citizenship in some areas or might be able to benefit from the universal injunction, or sorry, the injunction of some areas, but and the majority of the United States are not going to be able to be protected.
The Attorney General for the state of Illinois, Kwame Raoul, is one of the plaintiffs in this case. He said birthright citizenship, a rule that has governed our country since the end of the Civil War, remains the law in Illinois. So that gets to what you're referring to as sort of a patchwork and what we've seen play out in the abortion issue. Is Illinois going to become an oasis of some kind in this matter?
I think that's interesting. So my understanding is that Illinois is not yet a jurisdiction where the executive order can't go into place. The executive order says that states should stop issuing documents that denote citizenship. We really aren't going to know exactly how the Supreme Court's decision is going to go into effect and create this patchwork effect until the lower court decides how, or lower courts rather, how it is going to issue lesser injunctions. Because right now, like previously, we had a universal injunction. They can't start enforcing the universal, the removal of birthright citizenship full stop across the country. Now we have Maryland, Washington, and one one other jurisdiction where it is possible that the plaintiffs in those areas will be covered, but not others.
So what are you telling families here in Illinois?
I think that, you know, the Immigration Project is going to keep advocating for families as normal. Right now, I don't think that we have a great concept of what the lower court is going to do. I do think we have to wait in order to determine if kids are going to be able to, or like kids newly born in the United States or even in the state of Illinois are going to be able to access documents, or state issued documents will be valid.
The Trump administration sees this as a clear attempt to crack down on immigration. They seem emboldened by this ruling. What do you think are the consequences that could go beyond this particular ruling regarding birthright citizenship?
I think the Trump administration is viewing this as a win. And at least in the meantime, they have the option to start enforcing the executive order in whatever way that they can, which will at the very least cause confusion, even if the actual merits of the case are not decided in Trump's favor. I think it's, you know, kind of unfortunate and disturbing, as the dissenters in this opinion point out, that, you know, this facially unconstitutional executive order is being treated with a lot of legitimacy, and its impact is not being reviewed or considered in the opinion itself.
Yeah, what do you make of the fact that they basically punted and just made it about whether judges at the lower levels can issue a blanket ruling?
Well, in fairness, the court was only able to review whether the universal injunction was valid. However, I think what Justice Sotomayor and her dissent and Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson bring up is this is facially unconstitutional. We need to be reviewing what powers the court can and should have when faced with these extreme unconstitutional actions. The 14th Amendment is extremely clear. There's a lot of precedent supporting it. Individuals born in the United States are U.S. citizens.
That's attorney Madeline Cox-Guerra with the Immigration Project, and she spoke with Eric Stock. As the Trump administration's efforts at mass deportation continue, tens of thousands of people have been picked up by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement and put in jail to await legal proceedings that could send them out of the country. Since March 19th, more than 200 of them have been detained at the Phelps County Jail in Rolla, Missouri. Some are there for only a day. Others have been detained for more than 2 months. They arrive with no possessions and limited ability to contact their loved ones. Now activists have come together to try to provide comfort, assistance, and in some cases, clean underwear to the detainees. Jonathan All reports.
The Phelps County Jail is an unassuming red brick building tucked behind some trees between the county courthouse and Route 63, the main road through Rolla. You could easily drive by it and not know there are up to 400 people incarcerated here every day. And since mid-March, that daily population has included up to 40 ICE detainees brought in from places as far away as Chicago. The detainees arrive with no help, no support, and most of them don't speak English. Even though they're strangers to Rolla, there's a group of people here ready to assist them.
So that's the next thing to talk about.
Yeah, I have that.
Eight people are gathered around a table in a back room at Hopper's Pub in Rolla. This is an organizing and strategy meeting for Abide in Love, which formed this spring.
I have just been overwhelmed by everything that's been going on. So I said, okay, immigration is one of the issues that really is important to me.
That's Amy Beechner McCarthy, the group's president and a 30-year resident of Phelps County. She wanted to bring together like-minded people who wanted to do something to help immigrants in Rolla.
So that was my goal, is that we could bring about a beloved community. And the way we could do it here locally, hopefully in the future, will be welcoming all immigrants into our community. But the people that were in the jail, that's where we wanted to start working.
Abide in Love recruited 50 members through Facebook pages and word of mouth. They set up group chats and a spreadsheet to track inmates coming into the jail. they've applied to become a 501c3 nonprofit charity. Their first effort was to create a care package for each ICE detainee that they would receive after arriving at the Phelps County Jail. It contains snacks and hygiene products Abide in Love buys through the jail commissary. Each one has a sticker on it with a message in English and Spanish that tells detainees who they are and someone will be reaching out. Lucy Barrett is Abide in Love's secretary. She says they follow up using an app where detainees can receive texts and phone calls and put money in their accounts so detainees can contact their families.
And we're giving them a few dollars. And some of them have said, no one's reached out to me. Bless you, no one's doing this work. I do think it's making a difference because they're telling us that it's making a difference.
One of those detainees is Fernando Herrera Cruz. He was brought to Phelps County Jail from Lake of the Ozarks. The trailer he was hauling for his roofing job got a flat tire and was blocking the street. When police arrived, he was arrested and brought in by ICE. He says he had no way to contact his family until Abide in Love found him.
If you don't have family here, well, you can't communicate with them. If no one puts money in your account from the outside, then you can't speak to anyone.
Herrera Cruz says the guards at Phelps County Jail don't speak Spanish, making it difficult to understand directions. He also says Abide in Love's efforts to get him basic clothing items have meant a lot.
When you get here, they take your belongings. They don't give you socks. They don't give you boxers. They don't give you shirts. Just the uniform. And you're left without boxers, without socks, and it's really cold.
The Phelps County Jail has a few dozen ICE detainees each day. Some are here only for one night before being sent to another jail or to be deported. Others have been here for more than 2 months. The reason they're here, often far away from where they were arrested, is Phelps County has had a contract with the federal government to house inmates for more than 20 years. For most of that time, they consisted of people arrested by the U.S. Marshal or military police at nearby Fort Leonard Wood. But in January, the jail completed and opened a $17 million expansion that doubled its capacity. Shortly after, the Trump administration started its mass deportation efforts, and ICE piggybacked on those existing federal contracts with jails around the country, and the Phelps County Jail had space. Mike Kern is the Phelps County Sheriff. He says the revenue that comes with holding people from other jurisdictions has been part of his department's economic operation for years.
We self-generate funds to run this department. You know, a very small percentage comes out of county coffers. And so, and we've done that for over 20 years.
Phelps County gets $85 a night to house a federal detainee. Multiply that by 35 ICE detainees, and that's about $3,000 a night. But Kern says it's too soon to know what the massive increase in ICE detainees means for Phelps County's bottom line, because he's had to hire more staff to meet federal requirements for paperwork and transportation. Kern supports Abide in Love's efforts. He's met with the group multiple times, helps them navigate the jail's protocols, and it's his staff that puts the stickers on the care packages. Kern says Abide in Love is an example of Phelps County's generosity and compassion.
It's our job to hold people. It's not our job to punish people. We try to give them the best environment for, you know, a tough time in their life. I mean, we're here to keep them safe, to get them through the process, and to house them. And if anything would make that easier on them, I'm willing to do that.
Abide in Love members are quick to praise Kern for his help and willingness to work with them. While the relationship is amiable, it may operate at a surface level. There are frustrations with the overall conditions at the Phelps County Jail, where some detainees say they haven't felt sunshine or breathed fresh air in months. Max Toline is an Abide in Love member. He says Phelps County's cooperation doesn't mitigate his concerns that ICE's actions are immoral and unconstitutional. He says Abide in Love will work within the system to help detainees, but it's also a protest and expression of patriotism.
Abide in Love is a group that has an idea about how this country could become a better place based on the way we are living in it and the kindness that we show to our neighbors and the respect and the love that we show to our neighbors. They are the height of patriotic.
Toline concedes that may be a minority opinion in Phelps County, where more than 70% of voters cast ballots for Donald Trump in the last election. Abide in Love is raising money and hopes to expand its services to help pay for detainees' medical needs that are not provided for by the jail. In Rolla, I'm Jonathan All.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along, and join us again next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app, and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.